You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and once again you find me live at Montreal Just for Laughs Festival, Juste pour Rire in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And having a wonderful time at the festival, I'm bringing you today an episode with Moshe Kasher, who some of you will recognise from now. What did I see him in the other day? Moshe had a tiny part as a hipster coffee shop owner. What was it called? Dark Milk, I think, or Chocolate Milk, on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. But he'll be known to many of you as half of the Champs podcasters. It's a brilliant podcast called The Champs, in which he and Neil Brennan speak to a different black guest every week. It's really worth checking out. They've had some fabulous guests in a very, very funny style. Moshe, of course. Moshe, stop calling him Moshe. He's called Moshe. It's so embarrassing. I did this in the interview as well. It's pathetic. I explain why in the interview, but it is not a satisfactory explanation. Moshe, as well as being a podcaster and a TV actor, he's also a writer. We'll talk about his writing on Zoolander 2. He's doing some punch up on that. And he's also an absolutely breathtakingly funny comedian in his own right. He has a special out on Netflix. You can buy a couple of his albums on iTunes as well. And I saw him live, as we'll discuss, and his show just took my breath away. It was absolutely brilliant, just incredibly high speed, very, very intelligent comedy, very passionate, and really about things he genuinely gives a shit about. Really inspiring to watch. So this is episode number 2 from Montreal, and episode 130 odd in real life. This is the brilliant Moshe Kasher.
Thank you, Moshe. I keep wanting to call you Moshe. It's Moshe.
Moshe.
That is so awful. I've been practicing it all week.
And then you fucked it up.
I literally fucked it, but I won't include this bit.
Why not?
I will. This is.
Or don't, because then it'll belie how popular I truly am.
Oh, you're right. Like, if we knew.
Right. If we knew there was even one man that couldn't appropriately pronounce my name.
I feel terrible. It's because my godson collects these little toys called Moshe Monsters.
Uh-huh.
And so
I'm a Jew, so you think of me as a monster.
I think of you as a toy.
A toy monster. And a little boy. A little boy
so
toy.
I saw, yours was the first show I saw here at Just for Laughs. How's that show going?
Oh, the show's good. You know, it's, this is going to sound pretentious, but just kidding. You know, Stuart gave me a little pep talk earlier. He told me that when it gets pretentious, that's when it gets real good. No, I was here 2 years ago. Did we meet 2 years ago?
No, this is my first one.
Okay, so I did 14 shows in a row. Now, I know that by English standards, or what's the right thing to say? British?
English? Yeah, British is fun.
Isn't one seem like you're a UKIP type of guy? And one seems like you're more of a...
We prefer to say Britain rather than England, because if you focus on England, then it seems like you're a UKIP type of guy.
Well, let me tell you what. I'm UKIP all the way.
Okay.
Okay, I don't even know the cultural landscape in any way, but
so
I feel...
So refreshing for someone to just come right out and say it.
I just feel like, to me, UKIP doesn't go far enough. Yeah, right. So you guys do Edinburgh and you do these like 30-day slog, marathon slog. Sounds fucking terrible. Always has sounded terrible. But I did 14 shows in a row here 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I said when they offered me to come back was, I don't want to do as many shows. I want to.
So these were 14-hour-long shows?
14-hour-long
like
shows.
Over 14 days or twice a day? Or?
Over 14 days, yeah.
Okay.
And then there were TV tapings that they do. And then there were. That's the thing that they do here at this festival. For those of you that haven't been there yet, they will bring you over to do your show and have some fun, do regular gigs. And then it, to supplement it, their whatever their deal is with the Canadian government and TV, they put all the comedians on television tapings to pay for the whole affair.
Okay, to pay for it. Right. I have no idea of how the economics of it works. I got here and went, I wonder if when it first started, there was a gala. Because now you've got Stewart gala, the Mike Myers gala. There's 20 galas in town.
Right. No, it was originally a court jester, the court jester gala. Mm-hmm. And it was the king of Quebec and his jester. And he would just come out and he would, you know, they would torture Jews or whatever. Perfect. And then that was it. That was what was a gala back then.
Yeah.
So now I'm here and I'm doing
the tapings and you're taping, doing the warm-ups.
And I'm doing the warm-up for the tapings. I'm doing these 5-hour shows, but I don't have a full cohesive hour that I want to be doing.
In fact, you said, I think at the show I saw on Tuesday, that you hadn't done any stand-up for about 3 months.
Well, that's also true. That's another problem, secondary problem.
Okay.
Which is for the last 3 months I was in Rome doing Punch-Up. I was the on-set writer for the Zoolander sequel.
Right.
Which was tons of fun and awesome and great. But definitely, I went to, the only stand-up I did the whole time I was there is I had a long weekend. I went to Norway.
Okay.
And I did a gig, and a random gig. I wasn't going there for a gig.
This is such a fabulous, this is a version of how Americans view Europe. It's the same for Australians as well. It's like, I'm in Italy, I may as well go to Norway.
Yeah. For you, it makes no sense. Yeah. For me, I'm like, when's the next time I'm going to be close to Norway?
Yeah, of course.
With an excuse to go. So I went to Norway because my friend was doing a tour of Northern Europe.
Okay.
And that's what that is, right? Yes.
Yeah.
And a UKIP. And so I went to Norway.
Send the Vikings back.
Yeah, right. That's right. Well, that's really a problem. They're barbarians, right? They're taking our jobs and pillaging our villages.
Longboats.
Yeah. So I did a set in Bergen and in Oslo, but they were 5-minute sets. So I haven't done an hour show in more than 3 months.
How did you feel just before coming out on stage at that hour?
Well, it's, you know, as you, I'm sure you know, it's like the moments where you feel genuinely nervous are rarer and rarer the longer you do stand up. So there's a part of you that cherishes it, you know, and I did feel nervous. I felt like completely distracted and not cohesive. I was looking at these jokes, trying to piece them together because the main bulk of the show that I want to do, my next hour special, is one really long story.
Okay.
And I didn't want to do that because I did that the last time I was here. And so
it's the little things like that that I think the audiences never get. The sense of, oh, I can't do that bit that's good because someone might have seen that from the last thing.
100%.
I've done that. I've burned that on TV.
And then they go, the festival organizer's like, it's great. Right as before I go on, there's some press in the audience. I'm like, that's the last information that I wanted. But anyway, I felt nervous. And then, as you know, the moment you get out on stage, a lot of times that just sort of wipes away. You go into this sort of intellectual muscle memory and you just get out there and have fun.
You did, man. You did loads of crowd work. I remember thinking, because it's the first show I've ever seen in Canada.
Yeah.
I was in there for I think the slot is like an hour long. And the first thing that happened is you had a support act, which to me is completely bizarre that in an hour-long show, someone would have a support. Totally standard here. So I come in, the guy's name, O'Shea, someone.
Which night did you come?
This is the Tuesday night.
Oh, that's right. The Tuesday. He was a random guy. I don't like going on cold. I think that might be just a cultural difference.
Yes.
Because I just...
No. I mean, who does want to go on cold? Edinburgh, we're all used to, you know, in the UK, we're used to going on cold. God, it would be amazing if we could all just swap into 5 minutes of each other's shows.
Why not?
Why aren't we doing that?
Why aren't you doing that?
Yeah, right. Because
no,
I think,
that's a question.
I think the stakes feel so high that I think people wouldn't do it out of fear that they would be seen as weak. It's like a zero, what's it called, a lose-lose game or something.
Right.
If all the stags had no antlers, fewer of them would die.
That's a classic quote from the Vikings that need to get out of England, not Britain. I don't believe in Britain, but I believe in England.
Okay.
Yeah.
Moshe is standing up at this stage.
Yeah. I'm standing up. I have an Indian flag that I'm punching right now. The Indians have a flag, right? Anyway, listen. Yeah, that's interesting. It's all cultural mores that mean nothing.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. We've often said in Edinburgh that it should, or I've certainly often believed that if all of the solo specials, I love the fact that people over here call them specials. We call them Edinburgh shows. And you'll hear comics in London saying to a London audience, this is my Edinburgh show. And I always think, they don't even know what that means. What are you talking about? It's a special. An hour.
Wait, no, because a special to me
implies
that you're taping it for television.
Yes.
It's going on TV or DVD or whatever.
Although even recently, someone I believe to be Ronnie Cheng has tweaked the language of that. I don't know if I'm misquoting him, but someone has said, oh, from now on, every show I do, I'm referring to it as my next hour-long comedy special. Probably because it's sort of a piece of branding that makes you think it's going on TV, although I'm sure in most cases
it is.
Oh, that's
funny. You know, in the States, people, I've noticed a new thing. People love to go, they love to tweet, like, running my new hour at the blah, blah, blah. And I just find,
yeah,
it, I find it so fucking obnoxious.
That's an incredibly deft humble brag. Right?
Oh, did you? Oh, you wrote a new hour, did you? Wow, it's a new hour.
And it needs, I gotta run it?
I gotta run it, because it will eventually have some sort of incredibly important entertainment industry related functionality. Yeah, there's so many weird linguistic little games that we all play. But yeah, and we don't write as much as you guys. That is just
right?
true. Oh, yeah. We don't write an hour a year.
I think it's considered, if you want to be in the game in Britain, you've got to be turning over an hour a year. You can have an hour off every 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Louis C.K. and Bill Burr do an hour special a year, maybe Hannibal, but most people, I think, don't do that. Now, I'll tell you the stereotype about English comedians. British.
I'd love to hear it.
I honestly don't know what. I'm an ignorant fool.
British is the correct. We'll go for British.
Okay.
It's fine. There may well be
white
Scottish
comedians
and Welsh white comedians listening to this.
Oh, God forbid! is that, and I don't actually know that this is true, so please, to your listeners, don't.
No, I would be fascinated
this
to hear
is literally
your view
what people say.
The stereotype.
They say that
I think to begin with, we're relieved that people say anything at all.
They say you're very polite and you've mastered the English language and we've got a lot to learn from you. Pinkies up while drinking tea. They say that you guys turn over an hour a year and that we don't. And maybe this is just our defensiveness, that the hours are not. I feel bad even saying this.
Please say it.
The hours are not as tight.
Sure.
They aren't as punchy and as, like, laugh a second.
Yes. I think that's absolutely true. And I think the sense is most UK comics who are turning over an hour a year, there's this other thing about theme as well. A lot of our hours are themed.
My father at the
end. Yeah, absolutely.
My daddy died. Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by why it's happened, why it's evolved like that. And I suspect it's because at the Edinburgh Festival, if there's 3,000 shows in town, everyone's desperate to have a hook to hang their show
Somebody's
on.
Somebody's daddy gotta die.
Yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely. I think it may only be 10 years until we're killing each other's dad.
Yeah. And that's when I killed Eddie Izzard's dad. Anyway, dressed to kill? Indeed I am. I felt like that was really good. I'm looking at the crowd.
You are looking at the crowd. I should explain for the audience. That,
I literally.
We're using the space that in tomorrow I'm going to conduct another one of these interviews, in a live interview. And
there's an empty room.
There's an empty room, but we're sitting on some very palatial chairs. And I'm sure that
on a stage.
Me. Yeah.
And literally when I did my amazing Dress to Kill bit, I just looked at these 200 empty chairs for a little bit of support from the audience.
I believe there's a sound technician in the room, but he's sitting down behind a sound desk and wearing headphones.
Didn't care for the bit. Not a fan. But yeah, right. So that's right. It's gone the way of the. By the way, I don't mind that. I like a little pathos, and I would say part of the. I would say maybe a critique I would give of American comedy is that it can be pretty devoid of pathos. It can be often. And I don't think it needs to have pathos. I really don't. And I know that I actually find it obnoxious when people laud comedians like Louis C.K. and like, you know, who's another example? The people that are confessional as that's the actual goal. That's the
yes.
As if
everyone else as well. He did 1,000 jokes and they were all hilarious, but he really fell short of.
You must.
My imagined.
Oh, it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't. It didn't. It wasn't exposing itself emotionally enough. Well, you know, Seinfeld isn't going to do that. That's not what that comedy performer has for you. Zach Galifianakis doesn't have that available for you. It's not necessary for every comedian. By the way, I love a good super confessional like pop, and that's when Papa died show, but I also love a stupid, meaningless kind of just series of amazing jokes. I mean, Stephen Wright never said anything. He's never
that's
said
true.
Anything.
No, I know literally nothing about his life.
You know nothing about
it. But also, there are probably comics out there who say a lot about whom I literally know nothing about their lives.
You mean it's all lies?
Well, I don't know. I'm not necessarily saying it's lies, but I think it's possible to have pathos without genuinely confessing a thing. Well, you know, because now there's a series of tricks, aren't there? Just like any comic, any host can go, I can get a laugh like this. I can do this with rhythm. I'm sure there are emotional rhythms that can be taken advantage of.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And also, we're all familiar. And I would say the thing that makes Americans roll their eyes at the Edinburgh-esque emotional gut punch at the end that gets you the, I don't know, what is it, the Perrier?
The Fanta.
You guys get the tap water surprise. Is that we are so used to one-man shows. There's being this one, well, that's what we think of it as, a one-man show.
Yeah.
They come out, you know, in a spot, you're wearing a turtleneck, you go, and it was 1972, the first time daddy touched me where he didn't belong. You know, kush, 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 lighting change, whatever. So I think that's where our brains go. It's like, no, we're comedians. We're not, no one's here to, but then somebody like, you know, Robert Schimmel. Yeah, you remember, did you ever see Robert Schimmel? He passed away, but he had this like powerful story about cancer, his cancer that eventually, actually, I don't think it did kill him. Oddly, this guy died in a car accident or something. Anyway, the point of all of this is...
Fabulous ironic twist at the end of the show.
Indeed. Yeah. But is that I think we're scared of emotional realism in the States, I think, a little bit. I think that's true. So like somebody like Louis is a good example who does this thing where there's emotional confession, but it never you're never going to see Louis like go like, and my daughter, you know, sure. That's not going to happen.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. To what extent do you think... Well, certainly in your own work, when you're talking about the reality of your own life, how much of that is confessional? How much of it is honest? I mean, I feel like it's honest. I feel like we're getting the real you.
I would say, I mean, obviously this is almost a cliche about stand-up, but I would say my persona on stage is me times probably three, you know, and turned up. Every story I tell, generally the stories that I tell on stage are based on reality, on things that really happen to me, which is really bad because I have to wait for things to happen to me in order to generate material. Maybe more things happen to comedians in England when they're able to.
I certainly know there are comedians who go out there actively trying to make things happen.
That's the best, right? When you're just trying to construct an extreme living experience.
That would be fine if at the beginning of the show they said, so I didn't have any material.
Yeah. You're like, this feels totally contrived. So most of the stuff that I talk about on stage is stuff that happened to me. And it's stories that, storytelling kind of a thing. Yeah, I'd say that's what I do. The most fun I have on stage is when I'm not doing material at all.
Let's come back to this idea. I think the reason I mentioned the hosting at the top of the show was I'm unused to that incredibly cold start.
Yeah.
To what seems to me a very cold start of, please welcome the Support Act. And the Support Act doesn't say good evening. And I'm not saying this of your particular Support Act. All of the ones I've seen, they come out and they go, hi there, launch into their stuff. Now, I've heard that's because when you're growing up in the clubs in the States, you can't be doing crowd work as an opening act because the headliner wants to do crowd work. And if you've stepped on their crowd work, you don't get booked again.
That's 100% the truth.
Sure.
And I would say is the opposposite true in England.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. The opposite is true in England. Also, though, let me ask you this.
Audiences in England will respect the headliner less for doing the crowd work that's already been done.
Right. But what about a comedian who that's sort of part of what they do?
That's if part someone of their is show. Particularly an improviser, like so, I would think someone like Jason Byrne, who's an Irish comic.
And yes,
Jason,
right. I've seen him.
Hugely involving and improvisational material.
Right, he was
in
a
there.
Spy that awoken to his real true reality.
That was the guy, yeah, and he could kill people.
He drove a mini, and he was like, "Whoa, how'd I do that?" That's or whatever. The guy, and he's like, he got on stage one day and he was like, "Oh," and there was some weird thing. I was like, "Ask this guy what he does
and
for a living."
And in the third film, it turned out that he actually was some asshole who decided to he wanted to kill people
and do crowd work. He was very good at crowd work, that guy. So Jason Byrne.
That guy. He could have an American-style host, sort of opening act, who came out and did 10 of stuff because he wouldn't necessarily want things stepped on. But the reason I'm bringing it up is you seem to me, unusually, in my limited experience of American comics, unusually gifted at crowd work. You did some amazing crowd work with that. This was the night when the elderly couple was in.
Oh, that was a true gift,
man. It was a gift, but you accepted that gift entirely.
I do have a theory about that, and this is going to sound pretentious.
Yes,
but I honestly believe people always come up to me, and I think I'm very good at crowd work. I think that, and I've always really resented the idea. I write a lot of material. I have dense material. I'm proud of my material. It's not that I don't have stuff that I've written, but I've always really resented the idea, and there's a shade of it in America too, which is, you know, that crowd work is sort of a crutch and that it's not somehow it's inferior in some way to writing stuff. It's different. I resent all that stuff when people say like, oh, Carrot Top, that's not a comedian, prop guy. Why is that not a comedian? It's not your kind of comedian, but who gives a fuck? I mean, what we're all going towards a goal, which is to make people laugh and have a good time. But anyway, okay, so crowd work is something that I actually take kind of personally, because I think there are people that are masters of it, you know. And yes, when you see a guy at a pub who comes out and he goes, "Hey, we got a hen party here, do we? Bluck, bluck, bluck. You guys gonna go eat some cocks or whatever?" Yeah, okay, fine. I get it. That's like, it feels rote, and like that guy would have said that any night of the week. But then you see somebody like, you know, Todd Barry or the late Patrice O'Neill, or who can change the molecular sort of makeup of the room by getting and sitting in that sort of thick energy of who's in the room. Because I really feel like the audience is the third, you know, it's like the third element, you know what I mean? It's like you have the comedian, the performer, you have the you have the stage, and then you have the audience. Like, the audience is, they're there, they're a part of the thing. And so I don't know why I want to ignore them. Some comedians do, and I don't think that's better or worse. Just like I don't think dirty is better or worse. I think it's all just the sort of tool set that you pick up. Anyway, here's a real pretentious part. Though the couple, the old couple in my show, they were amazing. They'd been married 52 years, and he met her in an elevator and, you know, and somehow convinced her to take a ride to work with him by the end of the elevator ride. And she said, you know, and there was a panty.
Yeah.
In his front seat,
singular
panty. And there's some great stuff. And I remember one thing I said that I was very proud of was, I feel like I'm at the beginning of When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah, right? That was fantastic.
I felt very proud of that. And the whole time, and it's actually a fun mental game, because the whole time, I can tell you this since we're really deconstructing it, the whole time I was doing that, and I'm really fascinated with the brain of the comedian, because mm-hmm. I was in the middle of interacting with them, and it was pretty special part of that show. But I was also trying to think of a line from When Harry Met Sally the whole time.
Yes.
So in some other area of my brain, and I wasn't able to do it.
Yep.
I was trying to think of a specific line that one of the old couples
That's
said to each other,
so
that
yes,
I could button that interaction by saying, you know, whatever it was, what I was trying to think was, there was a couple in When Harry Met Sally that they lived next door to each other the whole time, but I couldn't, that was the line that the old couple used the whole time, but okay. I couldn't. So I'm saying all of that stuff is churning in my brain at once. I'm interacting with the crowd.
Whilst you're absolutely not just carrying on a conversation, but continuing to be funny and inventive on one kind of A to B level.
Right.
There's also all the C, D, E, F, all that stuff.
A thing in my brain going, I know that there is a wonderful way to end this conversation. Yes. And it's if I can pull this reference. And I couldn't fucking do it that night. But nobody notices that. And so people will come up to you after the show and they'll say, did you plant them? I get that question a lot. Did you plant those people? And we're finally getting the real pretentious part. I really believe that there is in every crowd a story and a gift that every single crowd, and if I don't, there's always an old couple that's been married for 52 years with a panty on the front seat, always. And if I don't find them, it's because I failed to find them. It's not because they weren't there. You know what I mean?
Got it.
I just really, really believe that. Every crowd has a story.
That's a very generous, well, not, it's not even generous. It's just very human. It's like, that's very un-self-involved. Do you know what I mean? Like, as a comedian, we're so wrapped up in what we're doing normally. That's really refreshing to kind of go, no, actually, there's all these humans in the room.
Well, that exactly. But there's also, I mean, that's why you would look askance at crowd work, is because most crowd work has nothing to do with that. Most crowd work has to do with, like, let me, you know, pepper through the birthdays so we can get on with the show.
There's a checked shirt, Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. And it can be just as lazy as material. Sure. I mean, material can be extremely lazy, you know, and it's just this paradigm, I think, that we have, and it sounds like you have too, that it's somehow this other inferior form, and I actually don't think so at all. So I think, to me, when I have theories of crowd work. Like, there's like different levels of it, right? There's riffing. This is so stupid.
I love it. No, this is genuinely exactly what I want.
This is just my friends, but okay, so there's riffingtons. This is what we call it.
You're right, that does sound
stupid.
Yeah,
it's real bad.
It.
There's Riffingtons, which is where I'm riffing with the crowd. Then there's Rantingtons, yep. which is where I'm not with the crowd anymore, but I'm just like going off at what I call into space. You know, the Grateful yes. Dead used to go into space, they would call it, where okay. their set would kind of deconstruct and they would just start, you know, I never watched
yeah,
that.
I know the stuff that, okay,
right?
Yeah.
So when I can get, and I can unlock from the show itself and just start, I don't know what I'm even talking about. You know, I'm out in the fucking ether just like riffing and ranting on my own thought, you know, sort of stream of consciousness, thought upon thought. That's when I feel really alive as a performer.
So this is Moshe. I'm perfectly capable of pronouncing his name correctly. I just learnt it wrong. And it's very, very difficult to smack those little blocks of incorrect learning out of your head once you're in there. So apologies to him, anyone that knows him, and anyone else called Moshe. And anyone else who is called Moshe but pronounces it Moshe. There might be at least one person in the 7 billion there are in the world who does that, who is listening going, no, Stu, you were getting it right. As unlikely as that may seem. It's a possibility. More episodes to come with Patton Oswalt and with Andy Kindler. Those are coming out Thursday and Friday this week. I can't wait to bring you those episodes. I was so excited. I'll tell you more about them as and when they come. But what else? You can check out the Champs podcast that Moshe is a part of. That's gettable from iTunes and also from his website. And you can buy Moshe's albums as well. I listen to Everyone Else in the World is Going to Die, asterisk, and then you are. That's a lot of fun. But have a look at his Netflix special as well. It's very, very funny. So thank you to him for coming on the show. Thanks to you for listening. Remember, you can rate this show on iTunes. You can give us a 5-star rating at iTunes. And you can share it with a friend. You can go to www.comedianscomedian.com and check out our spanking new website where you can discuss this episode on Facebook. And you can tweet me at ComComPod. You can have a look at some of the merch coming up. And I'm generally, if you haven't been to the website before, check it out. We've just rejudged it all and I'm really proud of it. I think it's looking great. If you've got any feedback on it, I mean, not tedious HTML stuff, if you don't mind, at this moment. Let me just have the new website up there for a month, feeling good about it before we go, okay, we've got to change that and that and that. But there's some really good bells and whistles on there. And I think the most important part is that now each episode has its own page. So if you particularly enjoy an episode and you'd like to share it with a friend, then you can put the link for that episode's page with the discussion underneath. And it's just an easier way to share the show. So have a look at that. Of course, there's a donate button up on there at comedianscomedian.com. You can click the donate button or go to the donate page, which will give you an option of either paying a one-off sum on PayPal, or you can do a regular subscription via Patreon, or you can go direct to the Patreon page at patreon.com/comcompod. Your donations make a huge difference. They're the only money I make from this show, and all of them go into, every penny goes into making the show wider in its scope and giving me the opportunity to fly myself to LA later this year. In September, I'm gatecrashing the LA Podfest. And I can only do that because you and other people are paying for the show, supporting it. And if you're enjoying it, helping me make it more and more successful and help me to get my teeth into America and Northern America and all sorts of fun things like that. So if you're enjoying it and you want to hear from bigger, better guests every time, then please support the show in whatever manner you'd like to. If you don't support it, that's absolutely fine. There's no obligation. It's there for you as well. Lots of students often send me £2 and say, sorry, I'm a student. That's really kind and I appreciate that very warmly as well. But if you've got a proper job, if you're a pro comic or if you're a professional person of any sort and you think the show is making a difference to your life, then feel free to drop me 5, 10 or £20 or that equivalent in dollars or, I mean, we don't get lira anymore. Drachma? Who knows? Maybe soon. Whatever currency you fancy, you can chuck it all on PayPal and support the show as frequently as you like. Thank you very much for everyone that's done that so far. I promise I'll get round to sending my personalised replies to everyone that donates. Anyone that via PayPal gets a personalised reply from me. Patreon is a little more difficult for me to do, but I will try and make something proper that gives you a little treat as well if you're a Patreon donator. Donor is the word for that. I'm extremely tired, as you can probably hear. Let's get back to the brilliant Moshe Kasher.
Do you get to recreate? No, recreate is absolutely the wrong word. Do you get to perform like that when you're taping stuff for TV, when you're doing a comedy special?
No.
Or do you have to do transcripts and sign it all off? And
no. I not only do I not get to, I have a hard time sometimes accessing it.
Okay.
Especially in a 7-minute set. Like if I'm doing my hour, if I'm running my new hour long television special for television networks that are hour long, that have purchased my hour long content availability, I have to run it.
You really have to run it.
One must run, you know? No, but in my own special, I can get away with a little bit more of that. But I've only done one televised special, so that I really wanted to get my material out because it was my first one.
Yes.
Right? So in a 7-minute set, it's like the risks are so great.
Yeah.
You know, what if I go in and something doesn't work? I'm halfway through my set. It's like, well, okay. So usually I will just do material in.
Does that frustrate you?
Yes. Yeah, it's not fun to me. Unless, you know, I'm killing and because here's the other thing about the American system, I think, is we're very worried about burning material. Do you guys worry about that?
Yes. There are fewer opportunities for TV work in the UK. Uh-huh. Certainly, I have not done a great deal of TV work. The small amount I've done, yes, I was very worried about burning.
Yeah, you're worried about burning material. So it's like tonight, I'll give you, tonight's a great example.
And I'll tell you why we were still worried about in the UK, because you can't use the new hour that you wrote this year may well have 20 minutes in it that is either pathos or setups or looser story stuff with far fewer jokes. So actually, you've really only got 40 of new stuff, so the burning thing is more of a
yeah, totally. An issue. I'll give you a perfect example from tonight. I'm doing this TV set here in Canada.
I saw you warm this up last night.
Warm it up last night.
I don't remember which room.
By the way, I didn't know what I was doing 5 minutes before I went on because I didn't fully grasp that I was doing a TV taping this time. I was trying to wiggle out of it.
Okay.
And didn't. So last night I was like furiously scrambling, like, oh God, what do I do? What'll be acceptable on TV?
What can I use? What don't I want to burn?
Exactly.
Right.
What don't I want to burn? And then there's this other weird element, which is that the TV in Canada, I've done five TV spots here. I have never, and I'm not exaggerating, never one tweet, comment, email, zero from the TV spots here.
Okay.
And I'm not alone. It's not that I'm not good. There is that, but it's not that. All my comedian friends, same thing. No response. I don't know what it is. It's very weird. But I don't notice a difference in the ticket sales in Canada. I don't notice a difference in the online. Nothing. So there's this weird thing where you go, oh, well, what do you do here? You can burn material. You could use old material that you've already recorded. None of it. None of it matters. So I could do my question is like, do I do what I'm most excited about telling right now, my newest stuff, which is, you know, like that catcalling bit that you saw? Like, I love that joke. I'm very into that joke right now. And do I do that? Well, I definitely want to put it on my special, but does it matter? It's like this weird sort of negotiation. Like, maybe I can do it here and then also
it'll
put it on
absolutely
special.
Fine. And then something will go viral and I'll go, no, not that bit.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The idea that the one bit that finally goes viral from any Canadian TV appearance is the one I didn't want to burn.
Yeah.
So it's like whatever. I don't know. Tonight, I still don't quite know what I'm doing tonight.
So how often have you done Just for Laughs in the past? This is your which visit?
Oh, that's a good question. I came as a new face. Do you guys?
I am only became aware of new faces today, yes.
So when you're a young comedian, when I first started, there were two festivals. There was the Aspen Comedy Festival in the HBO Aspen Comedy Festival in Aspen, Colorado, and there was the Just for Laughs Festival. And it is definitely the brass ring that everybody was focused on. You wanted to be a new face at Just for Laughs, or you wanted to go to Aspen Comedy Festival. Then Aspen went kaput and no longer exists, and then it was just the one. So new faces. That was truly the opening, the holy grail of opening yourself to a career.
Okay.
And
did that work? Was it the holy grail in that everyone felt it was, or did it have tangible results? Did people come away from it and go, that's me made? Or that's me in the door?
Well, back in the day, this is the lore of Montreal, is that people would regularly walk out of new faces after a 5-minute set would walk out with development deals from studios. I mean, that was like, you know, de rigueur. People would come in unrepresented, no agent, no manager, no nothing. They would be plucked out of obscurity. They would come here, wow everybody with their, you know, with their Riffingtons, Rantingtons and material, and they would be given a development deal and then get an agent and a manager and their careers would. So that's the lore. Now, I'll tell you what happened for me, and this is that I went out and I almost got Montreal a couple of different times before I came, and I didn't get it, and I was crushed and fucking pissed off, and, you know, why? And my peers had all gotten it already, you know? And I of my group that started, I was definitely the last one of the people that did get plucked at all, I was the last one to get plucked.
Yeah.
And so I was very frustrated and very upset. And then finally, I got New Faces in 2009 or 8, something like that. And we were all calling ourselves Old Faces. Our in-joke inside because we all felt we're a little bit – we're past this. We should be past this. But the one thing I noticed was a few things. Everybody there had a manager and an agent already. That landscape has changed because just because of the status of getting new faces was so high that agencies slowly started to like really push.
This guy might be a new face.
Face. We just signed. Yeah. You know, he's a brand new face. He's got no opportunities. The William Morris Endeavor Agency is. You know what I mean? It's like, maybe they have an opportunity. So everybody's now they've got a new thing that they've sprung out the back, the butthole of the new faces, which is New Faces Unwrapped. So it's really what New Faces used to be.
New Faces, basically.
Now it's like New Faces Light. And I'm sure they're all great too, but they just don't have managers and agents, which is what it originally was. So this whole thing has become very complex in its sort of strivings and motivations. But everybody had a representative. Everybody already had an agent and a manager. And you get here and you realize these shows are abject shit. I mean, they are horrifying, but they are bad.
From the point of view of the performer.
Of the performer, because...
Like, the skills are all great. The comics aren't
comics
shit.
Are great.
The comics are great.
No, the comics
but
are
you
good.
You mean the experience is horrible.
Most of the comics are good. And some of them are just people with powerful agents, but most of them are very good. And the room is filled with... Who do you think it's filled with? Who is going to be attracted to the New Faces comedy show? Is it going to be comedy fans? Like, oh, I can't wait to go see a bevy of unknown talent I've never heard of. Or is it going to be two-thirds like stodgy network executives and, you know, casting people? I mean, it's the worst crowd you could imagine.
Sure.
So you get out. You don't have any fun because you are convinced that the 7 minutes...
If I just nail this seven
and don't fuck around, don't have a good time, which is the enemy. I mean, the ultimate enemy of comedy, right? It's like, I got to get the... Got to do the... You know? Mm-hmm. And so... And then it doesn't matter. None of it matters. It might get you a little bit of peak people's interest, but really, in the end, what matters is how good are you in the long run? Who are your friends that are going to work with you and continue this thing? None of it matters, but you think everything about it matters. But the other interesting thing is I didn't get it for a few years, and by the time I did do New Faces, I was so developed as a performer that I felt like, oh, I actually have a product. I have a voice and a honed persona that I wouldn't have had. I might have been able to get laughs, but it wouldn't have intrigued anyone. And
let's talk about that. That is a really interesting way. That word intrigued is a really interesting way of kind of passing what do we mean by a persona and a voice.
Well, we call it in this show that I was working on last year, Comedy Central's Another Period I was on, and there was this thing that we would call the who gives a shit test.
Yeah.
Right? So this person's good. But who gives a shit?
That's I think that might be a line from a Patton Oswalt routine.
Is that right?
Yeah. He talks about seeing the open spot on heroin. He says there's a bunch of, you know, he's talking, and he uses a similar sort of thing.
It might be.
These guys are good and they're going to get better.
Yeah.
These guys are good, but who gives a shit?
Yeah, no, it very well might be literally wisdom trickled down from Patton's special into my brain. Sure. Yeah, it's such a good, I mean, it's exactly right. It's like, people can be good. We all know people can figure out the mathematics of getting laughs. And there's nothing interesting about it.
Can acts figure out the mathematics of getting people to give a shit?
That's a fascinating... Yes. If you're dressed up with enough artifice, I think it is possible to convince people that what you're doing is intriguing when, in fact, from my non-subjective, 100% correct, all of the time opinion, there's no there. You know, it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all Wizard of Oz. You know what I mean? You must know a performer like that.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it does no one any good to mention who they are or to even talk about the... Because it's just poison that you're drinking. You're giving... They say that. This is probably Patton Oswalt as well. resentment is drinking poison, hoping the other person will die.
Yes, absolutely. You know? Yeah.
So, no, that was Henny Youngman that originally said that. Does anybody know who Henny Youngman is? No.
I don't.
He is a... He's like,
although I have heard that said to him.
Borscht Belt comedian who would say, he said, take my wife, please.
Yeah, okay.
That was his line. And then he would play a violin, literally play a violin. He was, take my wife, please.
I don't know that bit from like a Garfield take-off.
That's right. But actually, Garfield might have been sophisticated in comparison. No, I'm sure Henny was a great man. But what was I saying?
So as not to resent it, we won't mention any names. People can contrive intrigue.
For sure.
I think that sounds like a magic spell for comedy.
Yeah. And it is magic in a way. Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah. But I think that also interesting is like, you know, we've all seen comedians who aren't getting laughs that you go, this is rarer. But you go, oh, no, that person.
Yeah.
That person's got it. They've got a thing. They're not there yet. There's something, but no. They're gonna, once they put the pieces together, you know, they'll be there. The intrigue part is there. The persona part is there. I think I did that actually. I think that I had more persona and bravado and confidence than I deserved long before my act got sophisticated enough to support it.
So people still gave a shit before you were able to roof a gig.
Well, I don't know. I think that I was captivating and charismatic on stage before I was good.
Gotcha.
If that, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I can, from knowing that you, the small amount that I do, and having seen the small amount of your work that I have, I can well believe that.
Yeah. So that was true.
You get laughs from stuff that isn't just jokes.
Yeah.
Do you
exactly.
mean your jokes are great, but you get laughs by tone of voice, inflection, and occasionally prancing across the stage.
Prancing does occur. But I did tell, I was told very early on in my career, before it was even a career, somebody said to me, you're taking too many risks. You're having too much fun because you're not there yet as a comedian. And it sounds like bad advice. It wasn't bad advice. Actually, for me, I was getting up and I was fucking around too much. I was like, I was relying on my confidence too much. They were like, go to the lab, hone your act, and then come back. This isn't going away. Yeah. I took that advice and I just wrote, and I tried to get very disciplined on stage. And then I did this. I sort of went the other direction when I finally felt like, okay, good. I've got jokes. I've got discipline. Now let me crack this thing open. And that's a performer I feel like I am now.
Yeah. Just while we're with this idea of the persona and the person you are now, what are the key differences between Moshe of 10 years ago and Moshe now? In terms of persona?
Well, I could say there's a very, very key difference. In the beginning, I grew up in Oakland in black public schools, and I was like a wannabe kid, you know, when I was, how do you call them in England?
How do you mean a wannabe
like
kid?
Like a white kid that wants to be black.
Oh, yeah, okay. We don't ever really have a word for that.
But you have that.
We sort of do, but it's kind of culturally sensitive because lots of comics in the UK will do jokes about the fact that white kids talk like they're black. And actually, I think it's the case that white kids and black kids both talk like a particular perceived idea of who they should be.
Right. Right. You guys have all that weird class strata that we don't... We're not developed enough to have had. We just have...
I would say as a forward-thinking British person, I would say white kids don't talk like they're black because talking like you're black is a construction.
I've heard this before. Now, I've heard this before, and I originally got... this is going off the rails just
a bit. Totally fine. Let's follow
it. I remember somebody said that to me once about talking like you're black, and they said that's in and of itself a racist concept because how do black people talk? And it implies a sort of level of ignorance when you're saying that. And I thought to myself, yeah, I checked myself. I fucked up. And then I thought more about it. I thought, that's wrong. Like Martin Luther King talked like he was black. He talked like he was, you could definitely tell that he was black. You could also tell that he was, you know, had a divinity degree and was a doctor of religion. I mean, you could tell he was a,
yes.
So I don't necessarily buy the concept that talking like you can also talk like you're Jewish.
Yes.
That is a thing. I don't think I do it.
Well, this is interesting. There's a way into some of your material here. Your idea about people who seem gay.
Exactly.
It's exactly what we're talking. We'll come back to that.
So anyway, okay. Whatever thing I talked like, I was definitely influenced by the black community that I grew up in. Gangster rap, hip hop. That was my sort of persona that I had affected by the time I was 17, 18 years old.
Yes.
Then by the time I was 17, 18 years old, I started to realize, okay, this is, I need to grow up a little bit and get in touch with who I truly am and blah, 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 blah. I went through a transformation phase and I popped out, you know, through a series of warehouse parties and you know, self-reflective therapy sessions. I no longer really, that was no longer really, it was a part of my history and a part of who I was, how I grew up for sure, but I didn't affect an accent that was disingenuous, let's say.
Okay.
When I was growing up, literally I had a Southern accent, an American Southern accent when I was a teenager. I'm from California.
Yeah, okay.
If that means anything to you.
Yes, it does.
I had never been to the South. And it would come and go depending on who I was talking to. You know what I'm saying? Like my brother, I'd be talking to him and I'd be talking like in a sort of my more natural voice. When my friends would call, and, you know, I would pick up the phone and be like, hello? Yeah, what's up? Okay. All right, player, peace. Hang up the phone. And my brother's like, what the fuck just happened? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was just a part of who I was. And that I got past. When I started comedy, almost subconsciously, I was doing this weird thing where I affected this, like, black tongue-in-cheek, but definitely, like, black accent, black acting thing that was almost, and I realize now what it was about, because I still do a little, I do like to do it in my act a little bit, but it was most of who I was on stage then. I realized it was just 100% defense mechanism.
Yeah.
It was clearly a defense mechanism when I was a teenager, you know, maybe being a little bit intimidated by the fact that I grew up in an all black school and I was one of the only white kids there. And so we all tried to act like the dominant social group there. And now that was happening again on stage. So I would go up on stage and I would affect this kind of like thing that went away, and that's not that I would say that's the primary, in terms of my voice, that's the primary difference.
You mentioned something about your appearance as well. You had a bit of material about how you, or I think it might have been a digression on the night I saw you, that you used to stick your hair far higher up and have bigger glasses.
Well, when I used to have a haircut that was, I called it the Gitler.
Yeah.
The gay Hitler.
Yeah.
The gay Hitler cut. That's what I said. And I had a whole bit about it.
Yes.
And that's an interesting story about comedy, too, is I would start my, that was my opener.
I remember you saying, absolutely. So you'd contrived a ridiculous look so that you could go on and make fun of your ridiculous look.
Well, no, actually, it was reverse engineered. I had a ridiculous look that then people reacted to that I then contrived.
Okay.
Their reaction.
Then you found like, oh, I'd better put my hair back like it was because that's my opener.
I literally got a haircut because of that. I thought to myself, I'm not going to be 50 years old. You know what I mean? I'm not going to be doing that. I will not allow myself to stay stuck in this thing because it's a.
I had a conversation with Todd Glass last night about how he did his first show here was in the back of a van and he had to ditch it. He basically drove it off a cliff because he couldn't be the van guy.
Exactly.
He couldn't bring himself to be that guy.
You know, when I did it, I cut my hair because I went to my hairstylist and he was like, funny story, this girl came in, like kind of butch lesbian girl, and she said, I want you to cut my hair like this comedian. His name's Moshe. It's like the Gitler or something like that. And
God.
I was like, change the hairstyle.
Oh, my God. Well done. Good instinct at the time.
Yeah.
Some parallel universe Moshes would have gone, great.
Perfect.
I'm
We're branding.
Somewhere.
Yes. The minions. It's actually, so I had like a sort of Hitler youth haircut, which is a popular haircut now. But anyway, I did that. And then I had an extreme look, but that was later on into my comedy thing.
Tell me about the writing. What do you look like when you're writing? Are you writing in a book? Are you wandering around thinking about stuff? Are you on your laptop?
I've never kept a notebook. This is one of the things that's unusual about me compared to other comedians. I've never kept a notebook in my life. I don't have my bits backed up anywhere. They've all been in my brain. I mean, I am the Jay-Z of stand-up comedy. Except as I get older, I'm starting to notice, like, there's a bit in my phone that I made a bullet point thing.
Yeah.
And I just have a bullet point. Men are the only ones who fondle kids.
Yeah.
I remember that joke. It's about the dichotomy between, it's this whole thing about men and women, that women are 50% of the population, men are 50% of the population, but the rapists, murderers, and child molesters, by and large, occupy the space of the, and that the women date those men. And that it was this, I don't remember the bit. It's gone. I remember it had some punchline about the space-time continuum. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how I got there. It was some weird thing. Like, and there was something in there that was like, I'm not saying I am a child molester. I'm saying I am infinitely more likely to be a child molester than half of the people in here just by virtue of my genitalia or something. Anyway, that bit's gone and that's frustrating and it never used to happen to me and I'm scared and maybe I have Alzheimer's. But
how old are you?
36.
Yeah.
So you think that's right?
It's around your mid-30s. I found around my mid-30s I started to go, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, did I take too many drugs?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's disconcerting, especially because my system has always been all of the material was filed in my brain and my bits are very long. They're very dense. I don't do a lot of jokes, set up punchline jokes.
No, you're a real long subject, like your stuff about gender in the show. You really get your teeth into it. You really savage the subject and pull it all apart, you know.
Right, and that's...
And it's dense.
Yeah, it's dense, and it was always just in there, and I had this ultimate... You ever read the autobiography of Malcolm X?
No.
Oh, you never have?
No.
Great book. But anyway, there's a character in there who...
He kind of writes like he's black.
truly a construct, my friend. But there's a character in there who runs the numbers in the neighborhood. He like does the sort of ghetto lottery or whatever. Uh-huh. And he's like, he keeps all the numbers in his head. And, you know, Malcolm X says like in another universe, in a parallel universe, this guy would have been like a great mathematician or an engineer. But in fact, because of circumstance and poverty and blah, 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 he ended up a criminal. Anyway, I always thought about myself as that guy. and now it's like
who would the parallel universe be if you hadn't ended up a comedian?
That's a good question.
Utilizing your skills as a comedian.
I wanted to be at one point an academic. I wanted to be a historian, a religious studies professor, and I started to realize I just didn't. What I wanted was the part where you teach, which is really just comedy, right?
Yeah. Right. Okay. And that's interesting.
I had no interest in doing research, academic research, and sitting in a library, pouring through Aramaic tomes, zero. Mm-hmm. So in another universe, what I would have used this brain for, sometimes I think I could have started a religious group.
Yeah, okay.
Sometimes I think I could, if I had been a little bit more of a sociopath, I could have started a cult.
Yeah, L. Ron Hubbard style.
Yeah.
Like just make it up, be open about the fact. I mean, we know from L. Ron, you can have this conversation now and you can still...
You could still be having it.
10 years later, you could start your own religion and go, no, that was...
By the way, I'm a committed Scientologist. I should let you know. I have actually been to the Scientology Center in L.A., and I must say, it is a delight. Everyone who visits Los Angeles should definitely go to the, not the Celebrity Center. It's a trap. But what's crazy about it is, I went there on a date once. It's like, it's so unabashedly like a cult headquarters. Like, it literally is if you went to a set designer and said to him, like, I want you to design like sort of a, I almost say cliche cult headquarters.
Oh my God.
This is the building they would have designed. It's so crazy that if you're weak of mind and spirit, don't go. But if you're a strong intellect and you feel confident who you are, and you're feeling a little bit confused about what the next life step could be, and you don't know if there are answers, there are answers. No, but anyway, I digress. That was a crazy experience.
That is, you went there on a date.
I went on a date.
Was it your suggestion?
Yeah, well, we had dinner reservations at this restaurant and we had 2 hours to kill. And I was like, what if we just popped in there? And you know what's fucked up? They do this thing where they go, here's the normal line emotionally. Yep. And here's where you are. And you're like way below the normal line. But like, it's like, hold on, motherfucker. Oh, and then of course it's, but don't worry, there is a solution.
Yeah.
Guess what it is? It's Scientology.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's like, hold on, motherfucker. You drew the normal line. Yeah. You decided that. Nobody, you can't just say this is normal. Who are you?
And well, who they are is someone who's been pulling that scam a million times and has made $1 billion out of it.
But what was really fucked up was my date that night. She did great. They were like, well, you're mostly pretty good.
No, that's part of the scam. They make sure that one of you does great. Oh. So it's you. You're the fish.
They identify the weak.
She's the hook. They
identify
the
weak.
Exactly.
Oh, very good.
Gotta be. That's like the same reason when you see people doing the three-card Monty on the street.
Sure, right. The buddy comes over.
Shill.
Hey, he won!
You're about to win. Bang! Someone else puts a thing there.
Okay. I've heard that. I mean, literally.
It's totally fine.
For me, it's fun. I need to keep commenting on it. Oh, it's important for your podcast listeners to know what's happening.
There is, this being the Just for Last Festival. Have you seen Kyle Kinane at this festival?
Yes.
He's doing a lovely little bit he was doing last night about the town needs a safe word because everything here, like there's a fire alarm and he's in the shower just scrubbing himself thinking, huh, just pour rear. doesn't believe in anything.
That's funny.
Well, just because people can't see what's going on for the slightly, the sort of mild banging noises have been because there's a big Just for Last banner behind us that has been being very gradually evened up.
I can't.
As if it were a giant painting.
But let me
episode of Faulty Towers.
For the listeners, like when I arrived, this banner was exactly bannerish. And then they've been slightly adjusting it to absolutely no effect for 1 hour.
That's why it's so marvelous.
Literally putting a ladder like an inch away from us, clearly in the middle of an interview. Clang, clang, just pour rear.
Hey, if you want the big armchairs, you've got to put up with the mobile banner. That's right.
It's a classic saying.
So we were into Scientology because we were talking about the writing and what it looks like. You don't make notes. You occasionally lose bits. So you don't write anything down?
I never have written anything down.
So you're only ever writing on stage. You have an idea for a bit. You go on, you add to it.
That's right.
So what are your, and this will be a harder question to answer, I guess, because if it all happens on stage, it might be a bit less kind of unpackable, if that's a word. But what kind of strategies do you use to pull apart an idea? Because that thing of getting your teeth into it.
Yeah.
I find in my early days of being a comedian, when I thought there was a way to do it, I used to think, what they've done there is, you know, the sort of things you read in bad books about how to do it. They've done an inversion, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't know what that is, but
or, you know, you take
is that a thing?
I don't know, maybe. Or sometimes you'll hear I tell you what, your joke about being transgender, about being doubly transgender.
Yeah.
So that joke, you take the concept, it's not an inversion, but you take the concept of being transgender and then you multiply it, you kind of square it.
Right.
So that I'm a transgender woman.
Transgender.
Who thinks they're a transgender or who is a transgender man.
Right.
So inversion. That almost... Yeah, well, no, I don't think...
Is inversion a misdirect?
No, but in the same way that a misdirect is a thing and an inversion, like saying the opposite of something, like Bill Burr bit where he comes out and says, you know, all gay people should be killed and then argues round to it that way. Then in a similar way, what the trans thing isn't an inversion, but there's probably a word for what it is. I think of it as a joke where the punchline is the setup itself.
I used to do a bit where I would say, you ever take a bitch home from the club? You know, you'd be at the club and you see a bitch and you'd be like, hey, bitch, come home with me, bitch. No, I don't talk like that. You ever be talking to a person that talks like that? And is that, you know what I mean?
yeah, a little bit.
And
like
literally
that
joke was actually, was literally just inspired by me being at an open mic one night, and a guy was saying it. It was an interesting bit because the guy was saying those words, but he meant it.
Yes.
He was literally saying, you ever take a bitch home from the club? And I just thought, what was the punchline of that joke? You ever take a bitch home from the club? No. I hate when people talk like that. That's right. I hate when people talk like that. This is an old bit. They'd be like, oh, you got to come to this party. There's going to be tons of bitches there. I'm like, oh, no. I hate bitches. Why are they coming to the party? Whatever, yeah. You think that's an inversion, though,
well,
the first part?
The word inversion might be a red herring. My point is there are particular things you can do to jokes. And I think to premises in order to get a joke. And I think I used to believe probably that there were, if I can just work out the mystical nine things you can do.
Right.
You know, then that's the formula. And of course there is no formula, but I'm just interested in like those examples that we've just discussed. What other, is there a regular way that you find yourself taking into a subject in order to get stuff out of it?
You know what the answer is almost no, but the closest thing I could say is that generally my comedy tends to follow the format of a real life story that becomes unreal.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Yep. At a certain point, it becomes fake. You know, like, does that make sense?
Yes,
like,
absolutely. You relate a thing as if it happened. You explore some
topics
within it.
It's a thing that truly happened, but then the story becomes abstracted to this area where, like, for example, that catcalling bit where I talk about, like, you know, my brain splitting into three. I talk about this woman walking by me and her breast was outside of her shirt. And really what happened to me. And the bit is that, you know, my brain split into three pieces, each of them telling me to say a different thing. You know, one of them, the more progressive side of my brain was saying, wanted me to say something progressive, like, oh, miss, your nipple, tucky tucky. Mm-hmm. I'm an ally or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then and then the other, there was an animalistic part. And that didn't happen. You know, the woman walked by with her breasts and out, yeah. And mostly what I just did was like, ooh, hummina, hummina, hummina. You know what I mean? Like, in my brain, it was like, wow, a tit. Mm. And then later, I really thought about that.
Yes.
That experience and thought, wow, you know, there's a moment where even I want to catcall someone.
Yes.
You know.
That's it. It's like you're an observationalist, but the observations are about your own reactions to things.
Kind of a thing, yes.
Yes.
I think
okay.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, because I felt your set, I felt like you were really talking about stuff in a way that I found really appealing. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, good. I'm really glad.
Yeah, well, you know.
Because, like I told you, I took the core of the show out this time.
Yes.
And it's mostly like me. I really am proud of that gender stuff, and I want to go further into that. But, you know, the through line that would be at my Edinburgh show, I feel like isn't quite there yet, you know, the connective tissue between the bits. And,
sure.
Because this is a show that it's a different show.
When you're finding that in the lifetime of this show, is there part of the process by which you go, okay, I've got that bit and I've got the gender bit, you know, and I've got a bit about hats and I've got a bit about something else.
Yes.
When you're looking for a through line, are you thinking, how does gender relate to hats? Do you know what I mean?
Interesting.
Or is that what is it when you find a thing?
Well, generally what happens is I go on stage. I tour a lot, and I will just find the spacing. Not only will I write the bits, but I'll write the set on stage too. I'll find the spacing. Oh, this goes here. Like, I'll give, like, this should go here. Like, right now it's not fully where I know it's supposed to be, but there's an area where it all becomes thematic when I can go, oh, I'm in love for the first time, so then I should put this stuff here about my, like, I can somehow wield that into my childhood, why it took me such a long time to fall in love, into the feminism of the household I was raised in, into the my stuff about feminism. I know that there's a place for me to do that, but I have a strength that is a weakness, which is I'm very skilled. I know this about myself, at creating false connections between bits.
That is an incredible observation about your own practice.
Yeah. On stage, in the moment, I can do that.
Absolutely.
I can do a thing.
I see people doing that. Yeah. It's so great to hear someone go, yep, I'm good at doing that.
No, that's a thing I can do. I can make, and I'm also, this is something I'm actually proud of, I think isn't a weakness. I can do it off of crowd work a lot. I can make a person think that I'm riffing a bit because I will do crowd work until I find a jumping off point that will lead into a bit that I go, oh, that, you know, and then everybody's just like, oh, the wizard is at work. But it's like, no, I was just looking for an escape hatch from this conversation.
Yes.
But I can do that. I can make any bit go together with a little bit of bullshit.
So do you have to really be strict with yourself and go, okay, that bit works, but it's bullshit and I've got to be better than that?
Well, I'm not even talking about bits, actually. I'm talking about, like, literally making connections from...
Structuring. I mean,
structuring,
in the structuring.
Exactly.
Of an hour.
And sometimes it is bullshit. Sometimes I can find myself like, okay, you're fucking pushing it. You know, you're trying to sound like a philosopher right now.
Yeah.
Really what you're doing is like, just like kind of going through your file. I just really think, you know, I think a lot about that. You know, I think a lot about the, and I'm like going through the file. I think a lot about the hats. I think a lot about hats. They cover one's head and people are so cold. You know, it's just like, so sometimes I feel like I
cold like my mother.
Yeah.
Oh,
maybe you would notice it because you, it seemed like you,
I've
deconstruct comedy a lot,
brain,
but I don't care about honesty. I don't think, I've never thought it was important. I mean, it's important in the world, but on stage, like, people go like, oh, but is that true? Is that true to you? It's just like, as long as I can stand behind the bit comedically, and as long as it's not like abjectly racist or homophobic or sexist, like, I actually don't care if it's like genuine and honest. There was an example that I had a joke that was a perfect example of this, that was just something that I didn't really believe. But I'm not able to pull it because I'm getting older and it's in one of the bullet points. But just like, I think really funny first. Like, I really, really believe that. Like, I remember Patrice O'Neill was on the, Patrice is a great example. Mm. Patrice, do you know his work?
I came to it very late. I've got two albums of his and I absolutely love them.
Love him. But, you know, if we're being honest with each other, his subject matter was vile.
Yeah.
I mean, it was horrifying, crude and awful. And I don't stand behind anything he said, but his rhetorical sort of power as a comedian was such that you kind of went like, fuck, okay, you can do this.
Yeah, I think with Patrice, he had real vulnerability in the awful things that he was saying. His stuff, when he was struggling to say, look, relationships are hard. It's hard for me to love you, to be faithful to you, all that kind of, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I do have I've got an example of a dishonest bit that it doesn't matter. It's not from my act. I know there's one in my act, but I'm not able to pull it. But I can give you an example. Kumail Nanjiani, friend of mine. Do you know him?
I do know
him. Very, very funny. Yeah. He's amazing. And he's got this bit about Ethiopians in this song, Do They Even Know It's Christmas? Do you remember that song?
Yes.
And he's like, it's a great bit. It goes, I'm sure they're singing something to the effect of, do they know we're Muslim?
Yeah, you know? Right. Yeah, okay.
But they're not Muslim.
No.
They're Ethiopian. They're Christians.
Yeah.
And it's a, you know.
It gets a huge laugh.
It gets a huge laugh.
Because it's satisfying. The truth of it, which is that the white Western world is patronizing. Yeah,
exactly.
That is true.
Yeah, that
resonates.
Is the truth. And it's like, who cares? That's what I think. Like, who cares if they're Muslim? It's an effective bit. It's great. I mean, who gives a shit?
Such a great example.
Like, who cares? I don't care. I mean, maybe they care. And maybe somebody will write a strongly worded blog one day. In fact, they are not Muslim your special 4 years ago, Kumail, or whatever. You know, but that's what I think. I think funny first. As long as you can stand behind your own bit, funny first, and then...
And you've got a really good put-down worked up, a very specific put-down for when someone stands up and heckles you regarding the truth of that.
Yes, exactly. I fucking wish I could come up with... I know that there's one in my own act that I realize is like just not the truth. And I just don't think it matters.
Can I just ask you quickly about Zoolander? Can I ask you about doing punch-up on movies?
Oh,
tell
sure.
me about that.
It's super fun. I mean, that's a thing that I think probably my Riffingtons definitely helps.
Okay, so you can do that when you're sat down writing, or are you doing punch up from the perspective of they give you a script and then you walk around doing your regular?
Well, there's different elements here, and this is what I would say. I actually think this is a nice button to our conversation, because with the people looking askance at crowd work, is I would say 50 to 75% of my skill as a punch up writer, and I think I'm pretty good at it, comes from the fact that I've got a brain that is conditioned to quickly reacting to stuff that's being said or being done. And when an actor makes a choice, so what the system on this particular movie, I've done a lot of punch up on a lot of different stuff, but the system on this movie was in the morning I would take the scripts, the pages that they were going to shoot that day, and I would write alt lines for the day. And I think that's pretty typical, right?
You'd write alternate lines like next to the lines in the script so the actors could try saying them instead.
Now I'd give it to Ben Stiller, who was directing, and he would tick off the ones he liked, scratch off the ones he didn't. Well, that's one thing you have to know as a punch-up writer is you can't get attached to these jokes. You can't get your feelings hurt, because that's not the job. The job isn't to always score. The job is volume. Enough that you eventually raise the project up, and so
you're almost being the super brain of the comic who's on stage flicking through the Rolodex.
Well,
you're providing the Rolodex to someone else.
A Rolodex. That's the other thing I think about is like Ben Stiller is very funny, obviously, right? He's a very funny comedic writer. We know that. The one thing Ben Stiller can't do that I can do is he can't not be Ben Stiller. He can only be Ben Stiller all the time. So I'm a different brain. So if you're good at punch up, the main thing you are is if you're good, you're not the person who you're punching up for. So you have there's no way a human mind can see a script from every dimension.
Yes.
So I would never have a script that I didn't have a punch up guy on. If I had the power and the money to hire someone, why would I not have another person there? It would only be ego that would keep me from doing that. So anyway, so I would write the lines in the morning and I would send them in, and he would tell me the ones he liked, tell me the ones he didn't. But then the rest of the day was spent watching the takes and me running in and saying, when an idea occurred to me, what if this happened? What if this happened? What if they said this? Oh, I've got an idea, say this. And often it would be...
And you get to do that from watching the tapes.
From
seeing it happen.
That's exactly.
Great.
And an actor might do something that was unexpected. He might say, he might riff his own line that was unexpected, and I would run in and say, okay... Also, there's no way to come up with every joke by reading it. Sometimes you have to see it for your brain to. So without crowd work, I really think, why would I? I would be like, well, it's about material. I already did my material this morning. Oh, we're done with material.
Yeah.
I'm a guy that writes jokes, not a guy that riffs them.
Sure.
So that movie wouldn't have had a bunch of the great jokes that are in there, I believe. So that's something.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you. Final question.
Yes, sir.
What would you have written on your comedy gravestone?
Thick dicked. That's all I care about. That's what I want the history to remember me as, a thick dick Jew that cared enough, but not too much.
Thanks, Moshe.
Thank you. We just shook hands.
So that was Moshe. Thanks to him for coming on the show. Thank you to Nathan Wood for co-editing, and Olivia Phipps, as ever, for all her podblin gremlin work behind the scenes. You can check out Moshe's podcast, The Champs, on iTunes, or indeed anywhere online. I'm sure you can Google it up. And look at his own stuff on Netflix. Very, very funny indeed. Remember, and I keep forgetting to say this during the main bit of the episode, but you can come and see An Hour, which is this year's Edinburgh show, my own solo show. It's on at 16:55 at the Canon's Gate every day apart from the 18th. And it's going to be great fun. I can't wait to get up there. I've got one preview left in the UK on Tuesday. And that's in Islington, but I don't have the details in front of me. And I think by the time you get this, it will already have happened. But one left and a load of shows to go. Can't wait to get up there. I think I'm looking forward to Edinburgh more than I have done. And I was looking forward to it last year. It's just getting better and better. I think I'm just freaking out a bit less. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? I promise to freak out still a little bit, enough that I'm a decent interviewer and can empathise with other people's freakouts. But I think I'm freaking out less. Really excited about this show. It's called An Hour, 16:55 at the Canon's Gate Daily, and it's completely free, so turn up early, because let's assume it's going to be hugely successful and be rammed every day. Let's just assume that. If you'd like to come and see the podcast live, they're underneath Black Medicine at the corner of Drummond Street and Nicholson Street every night at the Edinburgh Festival from the middle onwards. And I've got people like John Lloyd, Tommy Tiernan, Ronnie Cheng is going to be on the show, Joel Dommett, Daniel Sloss, Jason Byrne, and there's a couple of other biggies I'm chasing as well. So come and check that out. That's free as well, and you get the chance to donate, and hopefully by that point buy some sweet merch when you see me in Edinburgh. If you see me at a gig or a preview and you want to press some money into my hand and say something cool, that's fine too. Speak to you soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.